Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, Caleb Harper is identified as kind of farmer of farmers. His official title, though, is the principal research scientist and director of the Open Agriculture Initiative at MIT Media Lab. I have a lot of questions for Caleb, and many of you have had a chance to have heard him before. He's on YouTube, he's got lots of articles out there, and he's posing a really interesting vision, an exciting vision to many people on the future of agriculture and farming. And Caleb, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thank you very much. Excited to talk with you.
Well, you know, let's just kind of, before we explain MIT and kind of your background and so forth, I just want to jump right in to how you characterize farming in the world today, from everything what we refer to as peasant farming to industrial farming. I mean, how do you see it, the world today in farming?
Well, I think the world today is a manifestation of, you know, a kind of a call in the 60s and 70s to produce more cheap food, more affordable food for people to eat. I think during that time it was, you know, talked a lot about population increases and how are we going to feed all of these people. And so there was kind of a general trend to centralize production, to create a global world farm, meaning we're sourcing things from countries all over the world at all different times, so that when we arrive to the grocery store, we have all of the things that we want to eat. And that was an amazing accomplishment. I mean, the Green Revolution and what we've done with biotechnology to create that possibility of more food. Now, what we're seeing is kind of where that system breaks at the edges, where a centralized food system starts to fail locally, whether that's when an environment becomes contaminated, or when an environment has less natural resource to offer than it did before, or when our supply chains have gotten so long that we are decreasing the value of the nutrition that's offered in that food. So it's time for thinking about what does the fourth agricultural revolution look like. If the first one was domesticating crops and it basically dawned civilization, the second one was all about tools, and that created kind of a technology-based society. The third one was about advancing technology and vertically integrating. So biotechnology is squarely in the third one. So this fourth one, what will it offer, and how will that change kind of the way that society operates? Because food fundamentally has always done that. So I think that's kind of the landscape that we see ourselves in today.
And when you take in that view of the world, I mean, you're looking at everything from somebody that's got 10,000 acres of wheat in Kansas to somebody in Central Africa that's got a few acres and barely subsisting. I mean, it's just incredible how the range across the entire world.
Well, I think, and as you go across, you know, and you look at let's call them headlines or headline statements, you know, in the United States, 2% of the population is directly involved in agriculture, and the average age of a farmer is 58. So my big question for us here is, where's the next generation? What are they going to be like? You know, how do they enter into agriculture when we've become so aggregated that it's nearly impossible for a young person who's just interested in the field to compete in any meaningful way with, you know, big collaborative farms that are 10,000 acres that have million-dollar combines? But that question of the youth persists. When you go into Africa and you start talking about their issues, the biggest issue that they face is half the population being under 18 of the continent, and 80% of that population not wanting to be farmers because it's just very hard to make a living. They've, as a subsistence farmer, you know, that lifestyle is not something that anybody's dreaming of. And so that continent is full of 1-acre, 5-acre farmers because they haven't aggregated due to tribal inheritance rights. So what does it mean for a whole continent of small shareholder farmers when the youth doesn't want to do it anymore because of the volatility? It was similar when I was in Japan after Fukushima. Same kinds of problems. They said, you know, our breadbasket post-Fukushima, that's where the Japanese breadbasket is and was, is now contaminated, mostly with salt from the tsunami, and also obviously radiation was a big question. And so that's a natural resource contamination issue, but it was paired with the fact that the youth had left for Sendai and Tokyo a long time ago to chase tech jobs. So as this is what I've found as kind of a recurrent theme, and you know, it happened in my own life. I am the son of immigrant farmers that came to the United States during the land rush. As land aggregated, our family went to seek other opportunities that ended up being in grocery. And then now, my generation, you know, just like my dad told me, he said, don't be in food. You know, go do tech. So when you look across our landscape of FFA and 4-H and kind of that youth coming up, you know, we have a lot more interest in technology, innovation, you know, networking, kind of being a part of that new economy, the networked economy, than we do necessarily in being involved in the production of our own food.
Boy, you know what? As you say that, I was just thinking, my own journey, I grew up on a farm, and a lot of people thought, well, you want to get off the farm, you want to go do something else. I did, and I've ended up working with farmers and being involved in food and agriculture myself ever since. But now what strikes me, again, as you were describing this, is that you see young people all over that are saying, I would like to be back involved in food production. I would like to be a farmer. And these are people that maybe have advanced degrees from MIT or Harvard. But I also run into people that are laid off that used to work in the Rust Belt in the steel mills or something and don't mm-hmm. have advanced degrees, and they're needing to put together some incomes of several different sources to be able to support their family, and they think that farming could be some part of that. So So you see glimpses of people that are looking to a future, and let's talk about that future, because maybe you can kind of help them clear up that picture a little bit. And so if we ask you to kind of look ahead, and given the fact that population increases, climate issues in the future, and these people that would like to get more involved but can't do, like you said, they can't go out and get a $500,000 combine or get 2,000 acres of good farmland. How do you envision, what should it look like? How do you see this future of food production?
Well, I'll do the best I can, and I'll give a little background. So, you know, I'm an architect and an engineer. I professionally designed data centers, of all things, for HP in the United States, and then hospitals in the UK. And I was a specialist in surgical theater, which for them means operating rooms. So, totally foreign, right? Why would I be doing this? So, I learned in my kind of path of discovery that what I became good at was creating climates. I was creating climates for a computer to be more optimal. You know, when people think of the internet, they don't think of the giant data centers that are built all over the world full of servers to support the internet. And I also became good at biologic control environments for surgery that have to keep people safe. So I think that kind of person, the one that has gone away, learned different technology, different approaches, is now trying to figure out, you know, a lot, let's say more prevalently than before, the young people are saying, hey, I want to be involved. I don't know anything about food. Let's just be real. You know, there was an interesting study by the USDA that asked people generally in the United States what they support or oppose in government policy related to food. So the questions were ones you would expect. They were a tax on sugared soda, or they were a litany of other things. But there was a control question that said, mandatory labeling on food containing DNA. Okay, like everything that was once alive contains DNA, and 80% of the American population would support a mandatory labeling on food containing DNA. And so there's this, you know, and it's okay to say there is a general kind of a, you know, lack of information or ignorance about people and their relationship to food and what is natural. So I think we're going to see the application of very foreign fields in the production of new food systems. So data science, robotics, artificial intelligence, machine learning, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, of course, plant science and biochemistry. And what has maybe been somewhat lacking is a way for someone to contribute their specialized knowledge to affect a bigger system. And what I mean is, you know, usually people in agriculture and in agricultural research, they have very, very specialized knowledge that's sometimes hard to transfer. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you an example. You know, a 60-year-old farmer has some beautiful eyes. These eyes are fortune-telling. They somehow see fields, know what they need in 3 weeks' time to prevent, you know, let's say root rot or prevent spotting or prevent whatever it is that they know is coming. That kind of knowledge is cultivated over an entire lifetime, and it's very hard to pass on, and even harder when there's not a youth kind of ready to receive it. And so part of that future of farming will be taking that farmer's eye or taking that farmer intelligence and putting it in the cloud as a resource so that it lives on to the next generation. It can be kind of, I don't know what the right word is, like it can be added to as a global common resource that lives forever. So I think you're going to see in the future a lot of different disciplines, networking, open knowledge, this kind of farmer's brain or this farmer's eye, to provide local solutions. Mm-hmm. And those local solutions are cropping up already. When you talk about population increase, you can't talk about that without talking about urbanization. You know, I think it's 2030 that 75% of us are in the world are supposed to live in a city. Already half of us live in a city. So it's a pretty sure bet that there's going to be a lot of innovation and a lot of interest around how to grow specifically for supporting cities, whether that's in the city, peri-urban, or a new rural connection with new logistics and transportation models that use less energy, create less environmental contamination, and provide better nutrition at the point of consumption, which generally will be in a city.
Well, speaking of the cities, I'm going to make a connection. I think you were associated with this a project maybe at Target or about their mm-hmm. vertical in-store growing environments.
Uh-huh. Yep.
I mean, what's with that?
You know, it's a really interesting phenomena. So when people have voted with their dollars about food, and what I mean is you've seen the rise of organic coming from a tiny boutique category to a pretty huge category in American retail settings. And this was driven by people's desire, whether, you know, for good or for somewhat opaque reasons, choosing the term organic as something that represents better food. And so the retailers have responded to say, you know, we want to sell you food. We want to sell you food, and you need to trust it. You've told us that you don't trust a lot of things that are going on. So we're going to try to be as transparent and trustworthy as possible in our offering of fresh produce, in our supply chains, to be able to meet your needs. So one of those trends is growing potentially in the store, literally having growing environments, whether they're doing the full production or they're bringing living plants as they're produced in a greenhouse or as they're produced in a control environment or even in a field, bringing those in while they're still alive and offering them to the consumer. So there's a lot of going on in that space. You know, Whole Foods has worked with Gotham Greens to build a greenhouse on top of a Whole Foods in New York. I think Target's trying to take and expand that vision. You know, Target's footprint is huge. You know, it's funny, people don't realize, you know, when you go to a meeting with Target and Google, Target has the bigger wallet in the room. You know, these companies are absolutely massive, and they can make huge change. And people don't really think of it. So now you see Target launching something called Food Future Collab, which is kind of an investigation vehicle for them to say, how could we offer more trust, more transparency, and better nutrition to people that come into our stores? And I'm part of that group looking at building growing environments in the store. There's also really interesting shifts from companies like General Mills or companies like Campbell's. So Campbell's launched a big venture capital fund called Acre. So now each of these, let's say the big five food companies, are taking money that was normally in their R&D side and putting it into venture capital side so that they can acquire trust, so that they can acquire transparency, because that's what consumers want. And I think that's driving disruption from the store level to the product level, So things like, you know, I mean, it's really interesting, Blue Apron, right? Blue Apron is just a meal delivery service, but in the last 3 years, it's grown to a $2 billion company. So we're seeing kind of Silicon Valley's effect on food systems, and you're seeing the big five food companies being a part of that and supporting it. Food has become very opaque, for good or for bad reason, to the general consumer. So they don't really know much about it. So in this alternative future, I think maybe 30 to 40% of a person's diet could be grown in their city or peri-urban to their city or close by rurally. And that's kind of the eat fresh, pick fresh category of vegetables. Of course, things like corn and soy and wheat and rice, the staple commodity crops, won't really be a natural fit for the kind of new growing technologies. So I see, you know, restaurants or even cafeterias being able to offer things that you can only get there, and even retailers. So to be specific, you know, I recently started collaborating with a rare and ancient seed bank. I had no idea at the time that there are 10,000, if not 100,000 cultivars of tomatoes that are not commercially produced because they don't ship well, they don't have great shelf life, they are prone to pests, or whatever reason, they weren't chosen. You know, when you start accessing things that people have never eaten, like in our case, we grew tomatoes at MIT that hadn't been grown for 150 years. It's just a certain cultivar of tomato that was known to be an amazing sauce tomato, but it just couldn't be supported by the industrial ag system. So I think that might be where they start in terms of creating offerings of products that are unique, that are special to a region, are special related to people's diets. You know, one another future case is when you look at sequencing technology and you see that the human genome now can be sequenced for $1,000. You know, I think 3 years ago it was upwards of $500,000. When we can sequence so cheaply each person and we say, hey, what does this person need versus what does another person need in terms of the nutrition they're eating, I think we're going to get much more specific about what we're suggesting. You know, it's not going to be so many servings of this and so many servings of that. It's going to be, okay, with these genetics, you should really be eating a tomato with enhanced lycopene. And that lycopene is going to really be something that's effective for your body against fighting off something you're predisposed to have, whether a genetic condition or otherwise. So I think stores and restaurants may start offering things of that variety, things that could never be supported by a giant supply chain because they're just not producing enough volume to matter. I think it's kind of evidenced by where GMO has gone. GMO has gone only to commodities. Right, and until recently, we'd never created a GMO for flavor. There was the Flavor Saver tomato, right? But very little done on GMO for flavor, and very little done for nutrition until golden rice. So I think in the same way, you know, most of our eat fresh, pick fresh vegetables are not GMO. I think, you know, you'd have a hard time finding one. But they've also not necessarily been optimized for flavor or nutrition. And so this will be the big difference, I think, in that future.
Well, and I think you also have the theory that really we're describing what we're calling GMO. It's going to go way beyond GMO sometime soon, and that that term is probably going to become outdated fairly quickly, don't you think?
I think the term organic is on the same path as the term GMO. Organic is, it means a lot of things to a lot of different people. It doesn't necessarily mean that the object sitting in front of you, whatever it is that you're going to eat, is any more healthful of an object for you to eat as a person than a conventionally grown produce. So we're attaching a lot of emotional meaning. We're attaching a lot of kind of cultural association with organic that I think we're going to go past in the next 5 years. We're going to get to this, you know, apple or this tomato or this banana or this head of kale, since everybody's growing kale. This one used this amount less resources to get to you, still retains 80% of its original nutritional value that it had to offer you. And so maybe you only need to buy one of them as opposed to buying four of them. So I think we're just going to get more articulate beyond the term organic. GMO is another story altogether. I think the technologies of modifying crops, you know, what we used to take 10 years to do in terms of developing a breeding program that got us the result that people, a traditional breeding or Mendelian genetics style breeding, got us the result that we were looking for, we can now do in a day, and that's CRISPR. So if you can edit a plant's genome in a day, the same way it used to take us a long time to do, is that going to be considered natural, or is that unnatural? And I think that's a question that that policymakers are struggling with. That's a question that is hard to ask of a general population that doesn't really understand the genetic science of the things that they're eating, and are really trying to get a better understanding, and that technology is just running forward. It's like the 1970s of computing. You know, I often think of that because we call the objects we design food computers, and there's a lot of reasons for that, but it's so the same. You know, that technology what I'm working on is just like, you know, Jobs and Wozniak in their garage. a couple of crazy people with interesting ideas evolving so fast that you know, at the time people might have said personal computers will do better accounting or be a super calculator. Mm-hmm. They had no idea the kind of interconnectedness that would come as a result of having a platform, a digital platform for us to share information and ideas. The same thing is going on in food. The information of food is very hard to get. It's very expensive. It's usually proprietary information. We're going to see that radically changed because, you know, in a world where, this is a funny reference, but in a world where Pokemon Go, which is a game that you literally have on your phone, take a picture, flick an imaginary ball to catch an imaginary animal. This is all that game does. But in the background of that game, in 5 days, it had more users than Twitter and social dating platform combined, the most popular one, and it was a $1 billion company before selling anything. And that's because of the amount of data it's gathering about you. The same thing is going to happen to food. We're going to learn how to gather so much data that I believe we will literally see a time in my life where we are sending more information about food to places to produce it than we are sending food with cars, planes, and trains, you know, which is what the Industrial Revolution gave us.
Like what you're describing here is that we will start seeing more examples of what Target is experimenting with, and we may
definitely
see more maybe urban agriculture, stuff done on rooftops, and hydroponics, and where they're maximizing all of the data that they can get so that they can feed the nutrients. I mean, just give the plant exactly what it needs. I mean, you're sort of deconstructing Earth, aren't you?
Oh, trust me, I feel like I'm boiling the ocean all the time. Every time I learn about a new thing in plant science, or in LEDs, or in automation, or in data science, it really affects my project. But I want to make sure and say, you know, I don't think the future is one where, I guess there's this dichotomy set up right now between people that are advancing urban growing technologies versus rural. This dichotomy is just false. There is no us versus them. You know, in the future, you're going to see data affecting the field, but that's nothing new to a farmer. We've had autonomous tractors for 20 years. You know, people talk about autonomous cars now. I don't know when the last time you jumped in a combine doing a cotton field, picking a cotton field, but that thing runs on its own. It runs at 5 miles an hour. It's computing the yield as it goes. These are not new things to fields. We're just going to see them networked in a way they haven't been networked before, so that the things that are smart to grow in or near a city, that's what we do. The things that are smart to grow in fields so that we make farmers and rural environments more successful, that's what we're going to do. It's going to take all of it. And I think that's often missed in the way that people are thinking about it today. And, you know, they ask me, you know, do I hate dirt? I get that kind of question all the time, and I love dirt. You know, I love dirt, but, you know, I love soil more, which is great dirt. Not everybody has great dirt. When you're talking about China, a fifth of the farmland and being polluted in China, you start to realize that, you know, great soil is a high commodity, and it doesn't exist everywhere. So we do need to produce some kind of decentralized system that starts to work in those in-between spaces.
You're clearly excited and enthused, but I'm going to ask you to kind of pick your favorite enthusiasm here, like your favorite child, and tell me, what makes you the most optimistic and enthused about the journey that you're on and where it's going to be in the near future?
Oh my gosh, that's easy. It seems hard. I mean, scientifically, that could go all over the place, but it's really not the science, just the science alone. So we invented this thing we call the personal food computer, and it is 2 foot by 2 foot by 2 foot little box that controls climates. So this little box will never feed anybody, right? It is about experimenting and hacking and networking, and it's kind of in the vein of open source 3D printers back 15 years ago. And so we put this thing out there, you know, it's too expensive for what it does. It's really complicated. And I just said, hey, I'm going to open source this and share it and see what happens. And in 4 months' time, we have over 300 builders in 20 countries on 6 continents, all on their own volition, having built personal food computers to our spec. And all of a sudden, weird things are happening, like a farmer in Africa is growing moringa, a tree, inside of this box, trying to. Different farmers, as we call them, quote-unquote farmers, all over the world, making experiments. We took 10 of them across Boston Public Schools. And the most exciting thing for me is, you know, when a kid that's maybe in second grade is working with the food computer and they blow their breath out, they see the CO2 level rise in the box, and they say, oh my gosh, I never knew that what was coming out of my mouth would be good for the plants. And so that kind of visceral connection in a project-based curriculum is the most exciting thing to me, because we've seen students take the food computer, make robotic arms by going to Thingiverse, which is an online repository of 3D printing files, and taking Instructables, which is like an online community of people teaching each other to do things. And just by leveraging those free resources and the food computer, they created a robotic arm to pick lettuce. Now, is this a major breakthrough? Probably not. But it is now a kid in the world that thinks farming is interesting, that thinks that natively thinks that robotics and control design have something to do with food. And so that's what I'm most excited about and super passionate about, continuing to share our work out, continuing to see what young innovators want to do with it, and then supporting that.
Oh, what a vision. And now, this is the final question.
Okay.
So when you are sharing that enthusiasm that you have and the passion and the vision, and you talk about these people that can get excited about trying to connect, I mean, what advice do you have to them? If somebody is listening to this podcast and they say, boy, I really want to be a part of this, where do I go? Where do I find out more information? What's the first step?
Well, I hate to self-promote, but I'm going to self-promote. So, you know, we call what we do nerd farming. And so we've set up a community of nerd farmers. It's free to everybody. Join at will. Share information. Share your stories. So that is called if you Google Open Ag Forum, Open AG Forum, you'll find this little burgeoning community where people are sharing our bill of materials or sharing our source code or sharing data with each other. It's very small. It's kind of obscure, but it's people that are excited to do things together. I think that's a great way to get started. Try to build your own system. If you think you're into this, just take the next step. You know, whether it's building one of our systems or do what I did. When I came back from Fukushima, I went to Home Depot, I went to Bed Bath & Beyond, and I just started hacking, taking things apart, putting them back together, trying to grow plants, killing them all. I killed them all a lot, being fearless of failure, and then joining some of these communities of support. So, you know, we offer a Wikipedia page that links to a GitHub repo, which is where all of our code is. We offer increasingly more educational curriculum developed by teachers, not by us, but by teachers that know what they're doing, trying to help teach chemistry or biology through this new platform.
Well, you've answered the other question I had, and that is, why do they call you a farmer of farmers? What you just described is the whole process of farming to, farming for farmers, where you plant the seeds and you kind of cultivate those along until there's actually a harvesting of all these ideas. Caleb Harper, I really appreciate your taking this time to share your vision with us and the enthusiasm and excitement you have for the future. And thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.